It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We have Franklin Foer with us today, former New Republic editor. His book is called World Without Mind, about the dominance of Amazon and Apple and Google and Facebook. And we're going to be talking to him a little bit later this hour. I hope you can stay tuned. First, we're going to talk about World Without Obamacare, which didn't happen, did it? There was another attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act. It failed. That does not mean Republicans are done trying.
I've been up here 20 years. I've never enjoyed anything more. I believe this is the most important thing I can ever do for the country, working with my colleagues, is not to just repeal Obamacare, but to replace it with a system closer to where you live, controlled by people you can vote for. And we're going to get there.
We're going to get there, says Senator Lindsey Graham, talking yesterday about Republican plans to try again after they take care of the tax code. What does this mean for your health care coverage? Reporter Mary Agnes Carey covers health reform and federal health policy for Kaiser Health News. Hi, Marianne. Mary Agnes.
Hi there.
Repeal and replace, done for now, so we are left with Obamacare with President Trump as its caretaker. What does that mean for people listening to us right now?
Well, it means a variety of things. Number one, if you purchase health insurance on your state's health insurance exchange, or for the people that are in states that don't have their state exchange, the bottom line is you are going to be facing some pretty hefty rate increases. In the state of Washington, for example, rates are going up by an average of 24% a year. There had been some hope that perhaps there'd be a bipartisan package on Capitol Hill to help mitigate some of those increases, because insurers are supposed to tell the federal government today whether or not they're going to participate in the exchange. But some of those hikes are due to a variety of reasons, including uncertainty over some cost sharing, subsidies that help people with out-of-pocket costs. But the bottom line is you're facing these higher premiums. If you qualify for a subsidy to help you pay a lower premium, and about 60% of the Washington exchange customers do qualify based on their income, that'll help mitigate that increase, but it's still higher and possibly higher than what you've seen before.
What about for folks on Medicaid or people with private insurance? Are there any changes coming, or is it status quo?
Should be status quo. The Medicaid expansion was optional for states. So if you are receiving Medicaid through the state expansion of Medicaid, you should be fine. Now, states every year can revisit certain practices in Medicaid, the role of managed care, for example, copays or deductibles. That's true as well for if you get insurance through your job. Your insurer, your employer, rather, every year can look at those offerings and what you're required to pay. Those could change next year, as they always could, but this failure of Republicans in the Senate to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act is not really going to impact you that much.
Let's talk about those state health exchanges. And as you said, Washington State has that. And you said 24% average premium increase looks to be on the way. What is President Trump doing that affects that?
Part of the problem here is we talked a moment ago about subsidies to help you purchase your health insurance premiums. There's a second subsidy that goes to about 7 million people in the exchange, and that helps with cost sharing, your copayments, your out-of-pocket costs, your deductibles, and that kind of thing. The president is now renewing those on a monthly basis. There's a long history we won't get into about a lawsuit and judgments and all this kind of thing, but the bottom line is the administration is now deciding on a monthly basis if those cost-sharing subsidies continue. That makes insurers very nervous. So without the certainty of knowing that those will continue, what they've done is they look toward the 2018 premium hikes. They've said this has added about 20% to those rates, because if those cost-sharing subsidies aren't funded, the insurers are still on the hook to the people who qualify for them to give them that coverage at the reduced rate. So that has created a problem for insurers, and again, there had been hope that Capitol Hill would fix it, but that doesn't seem like that's what's happening now.
I understand President Trump has also made some changes, reductions to the help that you might expect when you enroll starting November 1st for a health exchange?
That's right. The Trump administration has made several changes in things called navigators. These are the people, the in-person assistants that could help you to enroll. That budget was cut by 41% for the coming year, and also they've really whacked the advertising an outreach budget. That dropped from $100 million down to $10 million. So that is a huge jump there. So another thing they're doing, healthcare.gov is the federal website that allows people to get in and sign up for coverage. That is actually going to be down on 5 of the 6 Sundays during open enrollment from 12 a.m. to 12 p.m. Eastern Time, with the exception of Sunday, December the 10th, which is the final Sunday before the enrollment period ends on December 15th. So the federal government is saying they need to do this for site maintenance. But others, analysts and proponents of the law have said, wait a minute, why would you shut the website down for the prime hours where people on a weekend might finally have time to actually look at the website and enroll? So that has caused a lot of concern.
Okay, so on Sundays, you'll want to go through the state healthcare site and not the federal one.
Well, if your state has one, Washington State, for example, has one, but for, I think, more than 30 states in the country, the state governments didn't set up an exchange, and they deferred to the federal government, so you would have to go through healthcare.gov to enroll. So if you're in that boat, I'd say get on the website on Saturday, not Sunday, unless you can do it before 12 a.m. or after 12 p.m.
Washington State's senior senator Patty Murray is leading the Democrats in a somewhat bipartisan attempt to help ratepayers. What is she working on?
She has been in negotiations with Lamar Alexander, who chairs the committee where she is the ranking member. It's called the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. And they were trying to come up with a package of reforms to stabilize the market. We just talked about the cost-sharing subsidies. This tentative piece of legislation, which has not emerged, nor has it been agreed to yet, in theory would put those cost-sharing subsidies in the federal budget so they would be stabilized for possibly a year or 2 years. They were also looking at things called reinsurance. These are payments that were in the Affordable Care Act for 3 years, have gone away. Insurers are hoping they'll come back, that help them with the highest cost cases. We know when the marketplaces for the Affordable Care Act, the online exchanges, opened in 2014, the first people who came in were the sickest people, the people with heart conditions, diabetes, perhaps cancer. They're very expensive, and insurers want some help with that. In return, Republicans wanted more flexibility for states to change some of the coverage dynamics under the Affordable Care Act. And also there was discussion of so-called copper plans. These are plans that perhaps would be somewhat less generous and less expensive than some of the ones currently offered on the Affordable Care Act. But when those negotiations were ongoing, you might remember after the Labor Day congressional recess, they called the HELP Committee. They had 4 very well-received bipartisan hearings with witnesses from all over the place, you know, different ends of the spectrum, talking about things Congress could do to stabilize the ACA market. But as the current bill, the one that just went, you know, the one that they're not voting on, the Graham-Cassidy bill, as that resonated, got some steam, the Republican leadership in the Senate said, let's stop these HELP committee discussions and focus on this other bill, which now is not going to the floor, as we know, for a vote. So whether or not Senator Murray and Senator Alexander resume those negotiations is unclear. They're having discussions. They're talking about it. But what's happening next, we don't know.
How much unity is there among the minority Democrats on this?
Well, I think that they would very much like to look at ensuring that the cost-sharing subsidies are made permanent, and if not made permanent, at least in the budget for a year to 2 years. That they're very, very clear on. The reinsurance payments they seem very focused on. Now, whether or not this whole state flexibility issue, which is already in the law, but a state would have to meet the same coverage parameters for the same price for the same number of people, whether or not they want to have flexibility on that, I think you could get some divides. But the thought is, could we as a body, could Congress come together to try to help drop some of these premium increases like 24% in Washington State? But it just doesn't seem, you know, they're really up against the calendar. We talked about earlier how insurers have to declare today. And we know that Republicans are not fans of this law, and Republicans are saying this reinsurance idea, helping insurers with the high-cost cases, is a bailout for the industry. Mm-hmm. And especially in the Senate, they're really upset that they didn't have enough support to pass their repeal and replace version that we just talked about.
Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent covering health reform and federal health policy for Kaiser Health News. Again, open enrollment for state health exchange plans starts November 1st. Mary Agnes, good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
KUOW's The Record continues in a moment. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. You have the right to remain silent. That's familiar, mm-hmm. I think. It's part of your Miranda rights, the list that people hear when police arrest them. Well, now King County Sheriff's deputies will start using a simplified version of the Miranda rights and warnings when they arrest young people. KUOW's Patricia Murphy's here to tell you more. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, Bill.
Why the change?
Well, it's really about helping kids make more informed choices. And it goes back to a number of researchers who have learned that kids just don't make good decisions in the moment. They're not good at figuring out the long-term consequences of their actions.
So I've heard.
Yeah, yeah. In stressful situations. Mm-hmm. And this can be doubly difficult for kids of color, black and brown kids, who have historically different experiences with mm-hmm. law enforcement yes. and in the community. So there's good research that shows that teenagers will acquiesce when the police ask them if they want to say something. So we've changed that here in King County for sheriff's deputies.
What is the change? What's different?
All right. So right now, if you're an adult and you're being arrested, you get this little spiel from the officer. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be provided to you. Do you understand these rights? Do you want to speak with me? The new one will have, if you're a youth in King County and are contacting a deputy, you will have the right to remain silent, which means that you don't have to say anything. It's okay if you don't want to talk to me. If you do want to talk to me, I can tell the juvenile court judge or the adult court judge and probation officer what you tell me. You have the right to talk to a free lawyer right now. That free lawyer works for you and is available at any time, even late at night. The lawyer does not tell anyone what you tell them. That free lawyer helps you decide if it's a good idea to answer questions. That free lawyer can be with you if you want to talk with me. If you start to answer my questions, you can change your mind and stop at any time. I won't ask you more questions. Do you want to speak with me?
Well, I can see that that's more clear, especially to a young person. But this is not a new discussion. We've been reading people Miranda rights the same way 50 years. Why change the wording today?
Well, you know, those Miranda rights were written by an attorney, and it's very legal sounding. Mm-hmm. But this reason, it makes sense because it really gives the young person hearing it very plain language that they have the right not to speak. And more than that, that it's okay not to speak to law enforcement. And if you do start talking and you don't think it's going, you know, well for you, you can stop. And that's a lot different than saying, hey, you have the right to remain silent. Do you want it? You know,
yeah.
You have the right to not speak to me. Do you want to take advantage of this right? That's different.
And what age are we talking about for this new Miranda version?
Yeah, they didn't really specifically mention an age. And I think it's just young people in general. When they encounter a young person, they're going to use the backside of this card instead mm-hmm. of the flip side, which is the current Miranda for adults.
Why not for people of all ages?
And I asked Sheriff John Urquhart about that, and he thinks not only should all law enforcement be using this new Miranda with young people, but there are a lot of people who could just benefit from hearing Miranda this way. But so far, it's just young people.
Talking with KUOW's Patricia Murphy. One more question for you, Trish, because there's an update about King County's plans to build a new Children and Family Justice Center. Some news this week out of the state Supreme Court. What happened?
Well, the appeals court found that the city erred in its calculations and the way it wrote the Prop 1 ballot measure that people voted for overwhelmingly to build this facility.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, it was a win for the opponents of that county's plan, but the county is calling it a technical problem, and they're going to appeal to the state Supreme Court.
That's the update on the Children and Family Justice Center and your right to remain silent and more from reporter Patricia Murphy. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
KUOW's The Record coming straight back. This is KUOW Seattle. I'm glad you're along. I'm Bill Radke. The Trump administration has reversed the rules on how college campuses handle accusations of sexual assault. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos is rolling back the guidelines issued by President Obama. Let's find out what that means for schools and students. Reporter Vanessa Gregoriadis has written the book Blurred Lines, Rethinking Sex, Power, and Consent on Campus. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
What was the Obama administration addressing with its rules on how campuses treat sexual assault allegations?
For years, American universities had really swept sexual assault allegations under the rug. They didn't want to handle it. It was just too complicated for them. So they preferred that victims would maybe, you know, go on their merry way. Perhaps they would drop out of school. You know, they would take therapy someplace else. This would just be something that the university didn't need to deal with.
Yes. So now these new Trump administration guidelines have reversed the Obama era rule that colleges should use the lowest standard of proof in deciding whether a student's responsible for sexual assault. That's the preponderance of the evidence standard. The Trump administration wants colleges to use the higher, clear and convincing evidence standard. What's the difference and why is that important?
Sure. So, you know, we all know that OJ couldn't be found guilty in a criminal trial, right? But he was found guilty in a civil trial. There's just a lower standard of proof. So the universities, in order to be fairer to victims who they had historically not treated all that well, they were using a lower standard of proof. That's what Obama wanted them to do. You know, a lot of these cases are very murky. Let's not forget, there'll be, you know, flirty text messages between the assailant and a student, you know, a matter of hours before the episode occurs. We really do need a low standard of proof here because it's really hard to figure out these cases, even in police departments. The cops that take on sexual assault are considered to be the true artists in the department. They are really good detectives. We need a low standard of proof here.
Well, President Trump's education secretary is saying that the Obama system created a system that treated the accused unfairly. Is there merit to that?
Of course, there were some cases where innocent boys were being railroaded. I don't think that any journalist who looks at the cases could say anything different than that. However, I think it's important to remember that we are talking about vast social change here. We're talking about a sexual assault that has been a scourge on American campuses for at least a generation or two. We want to take care of the problem. The campus court system that DeVos is so focused on is really a kind of sideshow. Let's focus on the problem itself and not get sidetracked by thinking about what cases may or may not have been decided, you know, completely fairly. Let's remember, in the criminal justice system, not all cases are decided fairly either, right? I mean, there are problems with both of these systems. Punishment is difficult.
Let's talk about some of the other changes that President Trump's education secretary is considering. She's eliminating a requirement that these campus sexual assault investigations be finished up in 60 days. It would just be instead a time frame that is, quote, reasonably prompt. Tell us what's at stake there.
Sure. I mean, universities under Obama's guidelines had to decide these cases very quickly, and that was hard for universities. 60 days is fairly swift for, you know, a sexual assault charge to be arbitrated and then resolved. But 90 days or 120 days is certainly enough time. And, you know, you have students then who will be maybe leaving for the summer. You know, they deserve to have this settled and be able to move on with their lives. So she has not given a time frame. And I would just say, you know, well, what does reasonably prompt mean? So a freshman girl can bring a sexual assault claim her, you know, her freshman year, and then maybe that wouldn't be decided till her junior year. I mean, that's not fair to her, you know. So what is her plan there? How come she can't give us a number?
Let's talk about mediation. The Obama administration did not allow mediation as part of its approved process. The Trump administration wants to allow these sessions where the accuser and accused would talk out their differences, if that's okay with both sides. Why is that an important change?
Well, you know, universities historically had used mediation for sexual assault claims, such as the University of Virginia, and they had some sort of informal resolution. It wasn't quite mediation, but they got in trouble for that with Obama's administration. You know, the fact is that, you know, not everybody wants to have some big tribunal. Not every student wants to go there and tell, you know, middle-aged administrators what happened in a, you know, a sex and sexual assault episode. Not everybody wants to go through this for some unspecified time period. You know, we're not all whistleblowers. Not everybody wants to buck the system, right? So you will have a lot of victims who will say, you know what? Okay, I'll just take the mediation. That sounds way easier for me. And, you know, then you may have some guys who've done some pretty nasty stuff getting away with it.
The Trump administration is leaving this up to colleges. In fact, Washington State's public universities have indicated that they are not going to change their system. So what are we left with? A patchwork of different college procedures?
Sure. Absolutely. Across America, going forward, we are going to have a patchwork. So at some universities, there will be a low standard of proof. It will be very hard to get away with sexual assault. At others, it'll be a lot easier. Religious institutions in particular really resented this intrusion by Obama. You know, some of those institutions, you're supposed to be abstinent, right, until marriage. They don't want to talk about sex with their students. They don't want to talk about sexual assault with their students. So they resented that, and they will deregulate as quickly as they can. Someplace like the University of Washington, who has come out and said, we are staying the course with Obama's protections, I think they should have the benefit of the doubt, because they very well may do that. But the real proof is going to be in the pudding, and you want to know, 1 year from now, are you still staying the course? For right now, let's say, okay, good, you know, we trust you. But they have to, you know, continue to be scrutinized and continue to have the public think about this issue and make sure they're doing the right thing.
You know, Vanessa, we've been talking about campuses investigating sexual assault charges, and we've barely talked about sex or consent or alcohol. How are students in your work? How have you found students are in 2017? Talking about consent and assault?
Sure. I mean, they are talking about it all the time. They're certainly not talking about the alcohol component, which I think is a grave error, but they are talking about what is ethical sex? What is compassionate sex? What is thoughtful sex? What is something that doesn't objectify the other partner? You know, they're living in a time when they have to post provocative photos for girls on social media, or player photos for guys on social media in order to gather likes, right? They're all just trolling for likes. They're putting out their sexuality in a very performative way. They're hooking up with people they don't really know through online apps, dating apps. And it, you know, modern sex for them is actually very different than it was for Gen Xers. You know, there's not as much like, okay, we're going to have sex for the first time. Are we ready? Is it okay? Should we take this step? I mean, these are questions that kids used to ask each other. And, you know, you find for this generation that they now want to ask those questions again, that they've grown up in a way where in order to be taken seriously, they have to be some sort of, you know, have some great sexual prowess. That's what makes a person cool. But they're saying, no, I want some rules on this. I don't feel good about what's happening in the bedroom.
Well, these are really hard conversations that it sounds like this generation's having compared to my college generation. And yet you quickly said that they're barely talking about alcohol. Why is that?
Well, you know, the binge drinking across America at college campuses is as high as it's ever been, particularly for women. It has been creeping higher. And, you know, it's hard for them to think of their sex lives and alcohol as intrinsically intertwined in the way that I do believe that they are. You know, when you're in that scene, it's hard to see that you're drinking to soothe your insecurities, right? You're drinking because you want to be hit on or you want to hit on somebody, but you're too shy to do it. You know, all of the ways that kids use alcohol to feel cool, to feel rebellious, to feel sexually confident. You know, it's really hard for a kid, him or herself, to really recognize that.
So then, Vanessa, if the students are the ones having the most nuanced discussion, or at least the most crucial discussions about consent and assault, how much does it matter how the Department of Education writes guidelines for colleges?
Well, you know, I'm not going to get on your show and say that this isn't a little bit of a nanny state, you know, movement here, right? I mean, the Obama administration wanted to go into your children's bedrooms, right? Like, let's just be frank about it, you know? They saw an opening. They knew the data that showed that women in college are at risk for student-on-student sexual assault at residential universities, and they wanted to fix that, right? But along the way, you know, they began to make some rules for consensual sex, too. And now that we're in a period of deregulation, and Betsy DeVos has said, I don't want to be in these bedrooms anymore. I'm not comfortable with this. I'm not interested in this. You know, okay. I mean, that's it. It's over. And now the students are the ones who will carry the torch. And I really think that they are.
What makes you think that? In terms of the discussions we just talked about?
Well, for my book, I spoke with, you know, 120 students at universities across the country. And kids wanted to talk about this. You know, I was a Gen X mother of two who was arriving at a campus food court in Ohio. And I was saying, well, what's consent? And nobody was looking at me with a blank, you know, giving me a blank stare. They were saying, okay, well, what is consent? You know, it's really interesting. I want to talk to you about this. I've thought about this because, you know, my college has posters that say consent all over the place. And I myself have wondered that, you know, in a philosophical, abstract way, and also in a practical way, like, well, can I hook up with this girl if she's so drunk she's not speaking English kind of way? You know, what's fair, what's ethical way? They are thinking about this.
Vanessa Gregoriadis, reporter and author of the book Blurred Lines, Rethinking Sex, Power, and Consent on Campus. Vanessa, thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Boy, in my lifetime, it has gotten so much easier to keep track of stuff. You want to know something? Google it. You want to find someone? They're probably on Facebook. You want to buy something? It's probably on Amazon. And for most of life's other tasks, Apple's in your pocket. These four companies have made your life convenient. Maybe they've made you rich. And if you're politically liberal, you probably enjoy it when their CEOs oppose President Trump. If you think the complacency I'm describing is mindless, you might enjoy the new book, World Without Mind, by former New Republic editor Franklin Foer. Great to have you here. Welcome.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
A lot of Americans are that satisfied with the Four Horsemen. What are they missing?
So you're right. Over the course of our lifetimes, over the course of my daughter's lifetime, in the last 10 years, we've had this flowering of amazing human inventions. There was no iPhone 10 years ago, no Kindle. Social media wasn't really a thing. And these technologies have delivered on all the promises that you've said. They've made our lives more efficient. When I wrote this book, I typed in many questions into Google and I got back instant answers. There were obscure books that I needed that I ordered via Amazon. And I've self-promoted the hell out of my book on Facebook.
Sure.
So these inventions are magical, but the magical qualities of these inventions disarm us in a certain way. And so we don't really take the dark side of these technologies very seriously. And so the dark side is that these companies are just so enmeshed in our lives right now. And we don't always recognize the ways in that they're enmeshed in our lives. These companies aspire to basically encompass us, to envelop us. Amazon was the everything store, but that was too narrow for it. Now it's expanded to do all these things, to power the cloud, to become a movie studio. Companies want to become our personal assistants, to wake us in the morning and to be with us during the day. And what these companies do is that they have a view of what we should become as human beings. They have a view of where they want to lead us. And
technology leads us toward the envelopment, or the CEOs have a plot?
The CEOs don't have a plot. They're pretty explicit about how they want us to merge with machines, how they want us to become more transparent in our lives, to share more. So this idea that we're merging with machines is something that we just need to think very deeply about, because we're not just merging with machines, we're merging with the companies that run the machines, and that those companies play an extremely important role in the way that we interact with reality. So if you want news and information, it's being filtered for you by Google and by Facebook. There's a way in which you can shape that, but really the algorithms that these companies use to provide order and hierarchy to the news and information that you consume are extremely powerful in picking winners and losers, determining the things that float to the top and the things that sink. And I think that this last election was just a supreme wake-up call, because we see that so many people get their news via Facebook. And Facebook is this feedback loop. Facebook takes all this data. They've amassed this intimate portrait of your mind because they've tracked you everywhere you go. And they use that data to try to keep you clicking. They want you on their site for as long as possible. And that means that they oftentimes give you what you want. So with politics, they're basically confirming your biases. Or they're trying to use various tactics to keep you engaged. So things that induce anxiety tend to rise to the top in Facebook. And here's the danger. When we live in this type of environment where we're getting what we want and our emotions are getting toyed with on the basis of data, we become prone to fake news, conspiracy, to demagogic appeals. And it doesn't just happen on the right. The same thing happens on the left. And you could see this even with the Russian hacking of Facebook and the ads that they were buying. They were buying ads that were trying to stir up anti-Hillary Clinton conspiracies, but they were also working to try to promote Jill Stein and other conspiracies on the left to try to divide the electorate and get their desired result.
I think we all know about fake news. So are we powerless? I, for example, you brought up Facebook, one of the big four. I do have a Facebook account. I'm barely on it. I have plenty of sources of anxiety besides Facebook. I feel somewhat in control of my use of it. Are we really that powerless and blameless as individuals?
Well, so you may be an exception, because to be sure you're in the news business,
yeah,
and that you have to read a lot for your job, and you're probably just kind of an intellectually inclined person, so that's the way that it, but for a lot of people, they take it as it comes. And I bet with your phone, you're probably a lot more powerless than you think you are.
Why?
How many times, well, I can just speak for myself.
Okay.
So I check my phone maybe 200 times a day.
Yeah, I'm a big phone checker.
And the phone is there's so much behaviorist activity that goes into shaping how we respond to our phones. We get notifications constantly. Those notifications are designed to capture our attention. There's almost a biological response that we have to these devices, where when they're in the other room, we start to feel anxiety. There's a phenomenon that I learned about the other day called phantom buzzing, that you're so used to getting text and other notifications to your phone that sometimes you start to feel that your phone is vibrating even when it's not, and you get this compulsion.
On your hip, you can feel it buzzing.
Yeah. But maybe it's not buzzing. There's that response that we have to these technologies is so powerful. And in some ways, it's great because we're connected and we get information and it's wonderful. But in other ways, we've kind of lost control. And this is a fundamental point in my book, which is that as our attention gets captured by these addictive technologies, and as we get guided to information and through the world by these technologies, we start to surrender something. We start to surrender a lot of our independence as thinkers. In some ways, it's just because we're being led to information. But in other ways, just being distracted and having your attention constantly commandeered by these devices and platforms means that we just have less time to contemplate things. So
what if I'm not that interesting when I contemplate things? And what I like, that phantom buzzing is so alluring that I'll check my phone. And I'll use you said it yourself. You Google, you Facebook. What are we supposed to do about this alarmingly pleasant situation?
So I think there are things that we can do as a society, and there are things that we need to start to consider individually. As a society, I think we have a proud tradition in the United States of America of dealing with powerful communication companies and other powerful corporations by imposing countervailing power. So up until very, very recently, there was a tradition of caring about monopoly and of applying antitrust regulations. Here's another shocker. There's no law protecting your data. There's law protecting your health records and other things, but there's no law governing the way that these companies abuse your data. And I think you would be not particularly shocked, but utterly horrified if you saw what these companies had on you.
And so I check my credit card statements for fraud, et cetera, et cetera. If there are more and more data hacks and identity thefts and all that stuff, won't there be that public outcry at the right time?
I think so. Because we treat these devices like our confidants, but even more than our confidants. We tell these devices things that we would never tell our spouses or our best friends. The things that we type into Google, if you're a young single person, the conversations that you've had on Tinder, for instance, let alone the text messages that you send around. I mean, this is just scratching the surface. We don't know what they have on us because we just pour everything into it. So there's a governmental solution, but then there's the question about what we do as individuals, which is so hard. And I can't say that I have the best response to it, but I think that one way in which this really resonates with us is when we look at our kids, because with kids, you always want them to do better than you've done yourself in life. And when we watch them when they're 3 or 4 years old, and we watch them swiping and getting addicted to it in the way in which the phone becomes the equivalent to a pacifier, that you could just stick an iPad in the lap of a kid and suddenly they'll be pacified. And there's a way in which this, at least for me as a parent, it's kind of horrifying to watch. And so I think a lot about what I can do to try to teach my kids to navigate this world in a way in which they are able to maintain their independence as thinkers, the way in which they're able to kind of have a sense of, at least some sense of mastery and control over these devices.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Always. Mastery and control.
Well, I mean, this is what you were talking about at the beginning, mm-hmm. and which is why I think a lot of us, and I include myself, is that we just have the sense sometimes that we're drifting. So it's whatever the next new thing is, we hop on it. If we abstractly care about something like privacy, but we never really take any active measures to protect it, and we just kind of assume, all right, well, things will probably work out okay in the end, and even if they don't, I don't really have any particular control over the shape the shape of things. I have to be on Facebook in order to have a sense of the world, or getting things from Amazon is so efficient and so much cheaper. Why wouldn't I? Would be a fool.
Can we focus on Amazon? I'm talking with Franklin Foer, whose book, World Without Mind, is about the existential threat posed by big tech, especially these four giant behemoths. Did you read the Wall Street Journal piece by Scott Galloway, who says we really should be worrying about one of those four companies, and it's Amazon, which obviously is based here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's saying Amazon is going to control, they're already somewhat do, and will control even more sectors of the economy. They're dominating cloud computing, hardware, search, product search anyway. Mm-hmm. What's your take on that?
Well, I fundamentally agree with him. And so, but the question is really difficult because you get to a subject where, all right, what is it that really concerns us about Amazon? Well, it's big. And we just have a suspicion that that bigness is maybe unhealthy for the world. But there's not a whole lot of guidance in our laws and our regulatory system about why bigness should be problematic.
And especially when they're not yet jacking up prices on consumers, well, which is supposed to be the monopoly concern.
That's exactly right. But I think that if you look at it in general, what we want is essentially to have as much of a competitive marketplace as possible. And Amazon, like the other companies, poses as a neutral marketplace. Anybody can sell things on Amazon. It's just a bazaar. When in fact we know that that's not really the case, that when it comes to selling goods in the marketplace that is Amazon, it's Amazon that privileges itself. And so you have this company like this that's growing ever bigger, that amasses ever more data. And the more data that it amasses, it allows it to further entrench its advantage as the supremo company. It's extending its reach into all these other areas of life where it's shaping news and information, and the question is, you know, are we okay with having this kind of octopus that's grabbing a hold of everything? And the core American concern about monopoly, if you go back to Thomas Jefferson and the founders and this tradition that extends through American history, it's that on some, you know, at some point a company like Amazon begins to become problematic for democracy if it starts to control everything. Just by virtue of its size, it's able to exert political influence. And so that we don't even, when Amazon buys Whole Foods, we don't even have a conversation about whether that's a good thing or not a good thing. Well, you know, Amazon, and so...
But frankly, we just have a minute left or so. Yeah. Microsoft used to be seen as a monstrosity, and today they don't even make it into your book, onto your list of four anymore.
Well, and you know who we have to thank for that? Is Uncle Sam. It's the U.S. government and the Clinton administration brought an antitrust suit against Microsoft in the 1990s, and that suit really had a chilling effect. Microsoft felt like it had to answer for its behavior and its powers, and so when it came to the future of the browser, they were more restrained than they'd been after the Netscape complaint. And I talked to many people at Google, and they say if the government hadn't slapped around Microsoft, then Google would have been strangled in its crib. And so we can see the ways in which, you know, antitrust and regulation, people say, oh, that's the enemy of innovation, when in fact there's a really long history of the U.S. government using regulation, antitrust laws, in order to create space for new startups and new companies. And I think that's a tradition that we need to cling to.
Franklin Foer, the book is World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. And you're in Seattle because you're at Elliott Bay Book Company tonight, 7 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
We really appreciate you coming in to KOW and shaking us up a little bit. Yeah.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
KUOW is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. In the dispute between Boeing and a Canadian jet maker, the Trump administration just weighed in heavily. The Commerce Department's imposed a giant tariff on the Canadian company Bombardier, a 220% tariff on their planes after Boeing claimed Canada and the UK were improperly subsidizing this company. Vaughn, Palmer is a columnist with Vancouver Sun. And Vaughn, this is a much bigger tariff than even Boeing was asking for. What happened?
Yeah, it's almost three times what Boeing was asking for. And the Canadian interpretation is we're getting into a serious trade war with the United States. I mean, this is a very disturbing early sign of how difficult the trade talks are getting between the two countries, because we're opening NAFTA, we've still got softwood lumber as an issue, and now we get this. It's a much bigger tariff than the Canadians expected, and I mean, it's being interpreted here as Boeing trying to drive Bombardier right out of business. This jet that Bombardier sold to Delta Airlines, they sold 75 of them. Delta bought the Canadian jet because the Boeing doesn't actually offer a jet that's that size.
Mm-hmm.
Its smallest jet is a little bit bigger than this one. So, you know, Canada saw it as fair trade. The United States saw it as has ruled that it isn't fair trade. It's a trade dispute, Bill, so you know it's got to go through three or four more rounds and there will be appeals and all that. But the immediate response of the Canadian government is our prime minister saying, if this is the way the United States is going to conduct its affairs, and if this is the way Boeing is going to operate, Boeing can forget about Canada buying $6 billion worth of Boeing fighter jets. That was our plan. That's what we were negotiating to do. But Prime Minister Trudeau has indicated that we will not be taking those jets if this is the way Boeing is going to operate against our big aircraft manufacturer.
Yeah, a blow against Boeing. And, of course, there are also many American suppliers of not only Boeing, but Bombardier, who are caught up in this trade war, that, and who knows how wide it would spread.
Yeah, and I see JetBlue said that they were looking to buy this small-scale Bombardier jet. Look, Canadian governments have put a hell of a lot of money and backing into this. I mean, it's an international dispute, and there's always arguments about what is and is not subsidized. But politically, this is a preferred and protected company in Canada, and politically, our government is not going to be able to stand by and see the market for this jet crushed in the United States by this kind of tariff, because obviously other American airlines are not going to look at buying this jet as long as that 220% tariff is hanging over their heads.
Well, Boeing says this is about maintaining a level playing field. How large were these alleged government subsidies compared to the kind of subsidies that go on all the time?
Well, the initial finding is that the accusation was that Bombardier was selling the jet below what it was costing to make it.
Yeah.
That's dumping as well as unfair trade. But, you know, this kind of stuff, I'm not a trade lawyer. Mm. There's a lot of technicalities here, but I know that every aircraft manufacturer in the world accuses its competitors of being subsidized by their home government, either through taxes, cash grants, or military contracts, where the military contracts are padded to pick up a lot of the overhead. So,
yep.
You know, there'll be arguments on both sides on this, but Bill, the way you led off is correct. This is shocking. It's three times the tariff that Boeing was asking for. That's how hostile a move this is.
And Vaughn, we have a couple more minutes. What's happening with Chelsea Manning, the former Army soldier who leaked classified material to WikiLeaks? Is she banned from your country?
Yeah, according to her Twitter feed, she tried to enter Canada last Friday and was turned back at the border because of a serious criminal record. The Canadian authorities at the border informed her that essentially she had been convicted of a crime in the United States that was the equivalent of treason in Canada, and therefore she was not welcome in Canada, and she was turned back.
Even though President Obama commuted most of her sentence and she was freed months ago.
Yes, but what? There's been some trouble at Harvard, right? She was trying for a teaching position there, and there was a bit of a pushback. Through her lawyer, she is saying that the Canadian authorities have misinterpreted the statute under which she was actually convicted in the United States, and that she was not convicted of aiding the enemy, and that's the basis for the president's pardon. But the way the Canadian authorities interpreted the conviction, they said it was the equivalent of the charge of treason in Canada. That carries a very severe prison sentence, and therefore she was not welcome in this country.
And Chelsea Manning says she'll challenge that Canadian ruling. That's Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Vaughn, thanks as always.
Bye-bye, Bill.
And this is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. One more thing, because we've been telling you so much lately about people being hostile and angry and divided. I want to tell you about an act of generosity that happened early this morning, about 6 a.m. My colleague, Marcy Silman, was rowing a boat west toward the Ballard Locks. She tells me the sky was just getting light, the stars were out, the water was calm, and then bam! The bow of her boat smashed into a big log that she didn't see in the dark. The log got wedged. She was stuck there, calling for help many times, when finally she heard a woman answer, "Hold on, we're coming in our dinghy." And sure enough, a little white boat putted out from a marina just east of Ballard Oil, and a man named Justin arrived and helped pry the log off Marcy's little rowing shell. Justin lives aboard a boat called the Argonaut, and Marcy woke him up with her distress call. As Marcy told me, he didn't have to get out of bed to help her in the dark, but he did. So she was a little shaky this morning, but grateful for Justin's kindness. So if you know a Justin who lives on the Argonaut in Ballard, or if you are Justin, thanks from Marcy Silman. And thanks from me for spending the hour with us here on KUOW. It's The Record, and we're produced by Amina Alsadi, Matt Martin, and Jason Pagano. Our editor's Jeannie Yandel. Get a hold of us anytime, record@kuow.org, on Twitter, on Facebook. Our social media producer is Bon Huberman, and we always want to hear from you. I'm Bill Radke. Come back again tomorrow for a flawed human conversation about the future of artificial intelligence. We're going to get into it with Oren Etzioni of the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence in Seattle and MIT professor Max Tedmark, author of Life 3.0. Until then, have a great Wednesday.